altie.com.
Today's Altie interview is in the context of the celebrations of the International Women's Day in 2022. It is a great pleasure to speak to Darshida Jellis. She is the founder and CEO of Manch in London. This is a company that helps others to measure impact efficiently. Impact and the measurement of impact is driving Darshida's life. She is asking the simple but brilliant and very important question, how can we mobilize our limited resources to create a better tomorrow? Hello, Darshida. Thank you for joining us today. How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you. Hello, Christian.
Darshida, let's start with the first question. You are the founder and CEO of Manch. Please tell us about your challenges and your experiences.
Thank you. I'll start with my experiences. There are lots of challenges, but I'll highlight the ones that are most pertinent and also in the spirit of International Women's Day, because I think a lot of the challenges I face can be generalized as well for the sector and the state we are in. Just for context, what inspired me to start Manch? It was a series of experiences in banking, in consulting, as well as working with big data on sustainability that led me to the insight that we don't have the challenge of lack of capital or lack of resource or lack of innovation. What lacks right now is what the biggest challenge the world faces right now is, how do we distribute or how do we allocate the resources we have in a way that helps us solve the challenges we have? And when we start to look at solutions, so how can we go about better distribution or better allocation of resources, then there are a whole lot of options and also a whole lot of challenges around alignment of interests that then one hits and bumps against. And so, yeah, for me, the genesis of Manch is born from the insight that we have capital, we have amazing, talented people, we have amazing innovation. We also have collective global will with regards to the UN Sustainable Development Goals, with outlines, you know, the world's to-do list for the next 10 years. So we have all the building blocks to taking us towards a more sustainable or a more thriving future for all in the next decade. Question is really like, how do we build that pathway together? And then, you know, speaking about, you know, the experience of building a company from thought into a thriving company with amazing people from many countries working on one common objective, I would say has been a journey of ups and downs. For me, when I started Manch, it was my first entrepreneurial dipstick. I have run companies before, but I've never raised capital for them. They've been consulting kind of businesses. This is the first time where I have had to learn about how to raise money, how to build teams, how to think about product, how to juggle between admin and product development and sales. So there are a lot of learning experiences in the last almost 4 years now. That I've had, and each of them I have made me much more stronger and also much more convinced that we are on the right path and we have what it takes to take us to that better future. And then just the final point on challenges, I think the main challenge that many researchers are putting forward is the lack of funding for women. So raising capital as a woman founder has been a challenge. I would say there are many investors who fund downstream investments. So when it comes to innovating packaging or green packaging or green energy, But when we're talking about enabling technologies, so technologies that can actually bring all of these green downstream innovations together to form a joined up view, there are not many investors who invest upstream because it's not a proven business model. So it requires a lot more risk. So I would say those are like the two biggest challenges on the capital side that I have experienced as a founder. And obviously, the common challenges most tech industries are facing now is that of talent. I think there is a lot of talent out there, but also there's a talent war out there. A lot of big companies can offer much better paychecks to good people. Startups definitely lose out because of the little bit of resources they have and the kind of talent they need to produce really good output.
This interview is part of a series of posts on International Women's Day. So we are really interested in why are you celebrating this day and how important is it to you?
Well, let's start with, I was born and raised in Mumbai in India. And just being born in the time that I was born, which is in the early 80s, is a miracle in itself because India is known for female infanticide. And so I think the role of women and the importance of women, obviously with more and more presence being given to that challenge, is changing and is being redefined. And I think days like dedicated days to celebrate a segment of society creates the opportunity to bring awareness to the journey we've been on, the contributions we have made, but also the potential that lies in fortifying this particular segment of society. So, I feel like creating dedicated days is a great way to bring our awareness to that. And I'm also at the same time not a believer in birthdays, anniversaries. Sometimes men get the flak for not remembering birthdays, but I feel like in many ways I I don't hold myself to days. So I do believe we all contribute every single day, but sometimes anchoring ourselves in a day brings global awareness to that collective stakeholder group.
Equality and diversity rarely happens overnight and by itself. We often tend to intervene to regulate things. What do you think of quota systems for women? How do you run the hiring process in your own company?
Again, coming back from India, we have had quota systems, and quota systems have been used as well as abused. So I think having a quota system helps to bring a certain segment of society into the fold of things where they have been previously excluded. In India, I come from a scheduled caste, so from a lower caste in society. Because there were quota systems, a lot of scheduled caste people were able to go into education, even though they didn't have the same grades as others. So the quota systems help in creating doorways for people who may not be as qualified or may not have had the right resources to be as meaningfully or as appropriately contributing as other members. So they do help. But then they also don't help when you don't really need a quota and you can actually get in just by performance, but you just tick the quota box because you know you have a stronger chance of getting in. So I would say to be used wisely is and to be used with, natural intelligence is where I would lean on. In terms of the hiring process in Munch, we are actually 80% women in the team. So we are skewed on the other side of the spectrum. But I am one of those proponents where I personally believe that You know, it's important to have D&I, but in a, you know, wearing, you know, my capitalist hat, it's also equally important to make sure that you have a team that is the most appropriate mix to deliver on the output that you want. And whilst gender and, you know, other diversity and inclusion topics are important and relevant, it's equally important when I'm wearing my company hat on that I'm looking at skills, I'm looking at temperament of people, I'm looking at sort of below the iceberg diversity and inclusion, introvert, extrovert, who is going to stretch the team, who is not going to stretch the team. So I'm looking at a lot more diverse factors that are probably defined by the psychology of the person than just the, you know, sort of superficial, how do I look, what color of skin I am, etc. And I really wish that very swiftly we are open to including a lot more diverse factors than the superficial diverse factors we're ticking the box on.
Diversity is way more complex. And that brings me to the next question. Where do you see the difference when it comes to inclusion and participation between people from, let's say, the OECD countries and the developing countries?
Again, coming from a developing country, I have a sort of firsthand experience of what it's like to be a member on the other side. Because of colonialism and although we didn't experience it firsthand, our parents did, most of our parents did. And a lot of conditioning and social limitation has been passed on to us. So I grew up in the context of feeling inferior. If there was, you know, someone from, I used to work with an international bank, and if there was someone from the head office with a different color of skin than most of us, even if I had an amazing or a brilliant idea, I felt inferior, and I felt like I didn't have the authority to bring my idea to the table. But it was not because of who was at the table. It was just because of how I was conditioned. So I think when it comes to participation, it needs to work both ways. Where I think the developing countries can help is by creating that opening and, you know, bringing the elephant in the room. Like, we know of the context and we can park that aside. And this conversation or this participation is truly in the spirit of collaboration. And we really want to bring your voice in. So having someone who has the upper hand or perceived upper hand, when they break the barrier, it's much more easier and creates a much more welcome opening for a developing country or a constituent of a developing country to show up as an equal partner. And then I think on the developing country side, I think we can definitely invest in internal development or consciousness development of our constituents, so we can rise above these limitations and barriers that I have had the opportunity to spend time on, but not many have. So I would say it's a two-way process. I definitely see very strong synergies in all countries joining hands. When we look at the sustainable development goals and what we need to achieve, this sort of cross-country collaboration is going to be key in delivering some of the larger goals we have. And a lot of the asymmetric treaties we have between developing and underdeveloped nations need to be rectified. And that needs to be a two-way process in order for us to build the next bridge forward.
Absolutely. And you bring us directly to the next topic. I would like to raise the issues of ESG. It has become incredibly fashionable to shine with sustainability. ESG is just so great. Is green or impact washing the new fashionable thing?
I would say I have actually my sense is that it's an evolutionary phase we are in. And whilst there is no black and white, especially in the ESG and impact and sustainability, I think the fact that organizations have taken a stance and put something about impact in whatever communications they have externally highlights the fact that they recognize that it is important for their stakeholders. Otherwise, they would not have put that information. So the first thing is to actually applaud anyone who is putting any impact or ESG communication out there. They're actually putting their neck out and saying, hey, this is where we are. Second part of it is, okay, is this accurate? Is this real, or are you just ticking the box to get more business, to get more visibility? And this is where I think we are in this transition zone where new regulations are coming in, where standards and definitions are being defined. So there is a little window which allows us to course correct wherever our claims have been open-ended or not backed by data. Companies now have the opportunity to take stock. We are putting this ESG data out there. Is this real? How are we tracking that? How are we benchmarking that? Is there any course corrections to our measurement practices that we need to be making? Are our claims too tall? Are we just claiming without a strategy and a real action plan behind it? Those are the kind of things that companies can now start to spend time and resources on, and that then hopefully helps them course correct if they have whitewashed or impact washed or laid out some green claims that weren't accurate. So I would allow for this next 1-2 years almost as a transition period for companies to course correct their action than sort of punish them for it. Assuming that, all of them are intentionally good players and moral players and will actually do what's the right thing to be done.
Tashida, the last question already. What is your message to people who are in the process of making the transition from education to work? In particular, of course, to the many international women who are listening to us out there.
I would say for anyone working from education to work, it reminds me of the time when I first started my job. And everything I had learned, I realized was theoretical. Nothing compares to your first day at work, because it is different. And even though I had interned before and it was all in the spirit of learning, but when you're actually in the workforce and not under any sort of educational context, it's important to recognize that what your employers want from you is your creativity, is an equal partner for whatever context you have been brought in to help with that challenge. So for me, it doesn't matter what stream of education you're from, as long as you come with the mindset of wanting to be a problem solver or a creative person who can bring the team together to solve a problem. So even like you don't need to know the answer, as long as you feel that and you can come in with that sense of ownership and inclusion, your transition from education to work will be smooth and seamless. So I would say a lot of it has to do with grooming yourself internally and making sure that you are making an internally congruent choice when it comes to work. I'm one of those few people who has tossed the notion of work-life balance. And because I personally see work as my life's work, if I'm spending 8 hours a day, 5 days a week on something, I want it to matter. And I want it to be something that I am proud of, that whoever I'm with is proud of. And as long as, you know, you can make these like little tweaks in your mind and make sure you are going from day one into your job that you're really happy about. You may not be clear about what you need to do, but you're excited about finding and making clarity for yourself and for others around you. That's where you will find success no matter where you go.
So be enlightened and burn for your ideas?
Mm-hmm, for sure.
That was Darshita Gillies. She is the founder and CEO of Manch. Thank you for this wonderful interview.
Thank you, Christian. Pleasure.
LTE.com, the online portal for institutional investors in Germany, Austria, and Switzerland. LTE.com.